torus spectrum and entanglement entropy and tuples one-dimensional conformal field theories. So just sort of give an outline. First of all, I'm going to talk about the finite size spectrum of the Wilson-Fisher conformal field theory on the torus. Then I'll sort of mention how that's useful in detecting the confinement transitions of certain exotic phases of matter by looking at the torus spectrum. And then I'll give some new recent results on entanglement entropy and conformal field theories in a certain limit. Okay, so to give a little relation to condensed matter, conformal field theories are very interesting just as mathematical objects. They also describe the low energy physics of certain interesting condensed matter systems. So at quantum critical points that have emergent relativistic symmetry or exotic phases of gapless matter, which are very common in one dimension, but there are some interesting ideas for phases in higher dimensions. And they also have interesting novel properties, such as universal properties. They don't have any natural quasi-particle description, and you have long-range entanglement in the ground state. Okay, so why would you be interested in the spectrum of the torus? So first of all, as I already mentioned, you have a lot of universal information for conformal field theory. So if you parameterize a torus, here I'm using sort of complex coordinates, you usually have, you can consider one length scale. Here I'm taking the length scale of one side of the torus and then the modular parameter. And then the energy levels of the torus are given by what I've written here as C over L times a series of universal numbers that only depend on the shape of the torus. The shape here being the modular parameter here. So here you have C, which is the speed of light. This is often set to 1 in theoretical calculations, but it's like the spin wave velocity, which is something that's non-universal and emergent for a given lattice system. So one reason that this is useful is to compare with numerics. So the energy spectrum is often best studied using exact diagonalization. And so in numerical simulations, the torus is usually the most accessible geometry that has translation invariants. When you're studying some sort of mini body system where you want to access the critical point, these are often the easiest geometries to do, as opposed to something like the sphere, where that gives you something like scaling dimensions of a CFT, but defining a lattice model on a sphere is very difficult. So something else, or the idea here is something which I'm calling energy spectroscopy, which is that you can compare the spectrum at the CFT with numerics, and you can figure out what particular CFT you're at. And what I'm going to try to talk about is, so this picture here is just sort of a hint at it, but I'll talk later about how by looking at not only the critical spectrum, but nearby, you can detect, I think, exotic phases like topological order. You can see symmetry breaking, which is already used. And one thing that makes this a good indicator is that the spectrum on the torus detects non-local aspects of the quantum system. So you can think about detecting things like topological order and emerging gauge degrees of freedom. So here I'll talk about the Wilson-Fisher conformal field theory. So this is just Phi-4 theory. This describes a lot of the well-known realizations of critical points, including some of the ones I mentioned earlier. This is just ON invariant interactions, and there are sort of well-understood perturbative expansions either in large N or in the epsilon expansion. I mostly wanted to describe the epsilon expansion here because I think it has some interesting non-perturbative physics. So one of the first ideas of the epsilon expansion is to, first of all, generalize it from 2 plus 1 dimensions to d plus 1 dimensions. But we're interested in a two-dimensional geometry, so you don't want to change the symmetries of your theory or introduce anything like a large unphysical dimensions, which could change the IR physics too much. So what I did was I took d divided by 2 copies of the two-dimensional torus you're interested in, which preserves all the point symmetries of the torus that you're interested in. And from there, you can take d equals to 3 minus epsilon. And then it's just the technical issue of evaluating diagrams in that geometry. And so the first thing that happens is sort of obvious. Instead of Feynman integrals, you get Feynman sums over discrete momentum. But the thing that happens, which is really what gives us an interesting structure, is what happens in the IR because of zero momentum modes. So in any diagram you compute, in any sort of attempt to compute corrections, you always hit this isolated zero mode, which gives you just a simple 1/0 and makes everything diverge. The physical origin of this is the fact that in the free theory, when you put a free theory on some finite volume, the zero mode fluctuations are just going to, I should say, a free theory that's massless, the zero mode is just going to fluctuate infinitely. So think about what the free Gaussian theory looks like. It's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. If you tune to criticality, where the mass term goes to zero, you just have a momentum term, and you don't have a conjugate position term here to localize it. In contrast, the interacting theory does have a phi to the 4 term, which does localize it. If I try to do perturbation theory to zeroth order, I'm just going to get plane waves, and then when I for the zero mode, and then when I perturb it, it's going to localize that. But actually, you can't start perturbation theory with plane waves and get discrete physics. So by perturbing around here, you simply can't get the correct physics. So the solution is actually to already treat this problem partially non-perturbatively. What you have to do is you have to separate the fields into a part that contains the zero modes and contains the finite momentum modes. So here I've taken the field and its conjugate momentum. So the finite momentum modes you can expand in harmonic oscillators, and to zeroth order you just get Fock states. And then the interaction term, you include the zero momentum modes as well as nonlinearities and everything else. And you include all of that in the interactions, and you have to treat those at the same level of interactions. So this idea was applied to some problems in high energy as well as classical critical phenomena before. And what you'll find is that treating the zero modes, which are at order zero of the interaction, along with the interactions, is going to result in a modified epsilon expansion. So the structure of the perturbation theory is as follows. Your zeroth order Hamiltonian is a tower of Fock states of finite momentum modes. So to zeroth order your unperturbed wave function is a series of finite momentum Fock states, but because the zero mode doesn't appear in the Hamiltonian, you can multiply them by any sort of functional of the zero mode, and that's a valid eigenstate with this energy. So you actually have an infinite degeneracy to zeroth order. And then as soon as we treat interactions, it's going to determine some sort of equation for the zero mode. And that's what we're going to have to solve exactly. So the method I use for perturbation theory is going to be an effective Hamiltonian method. This is just a particular maybe familiar to most people, a particular method of perturbation theory where you develop a Hamiltonian which acts on the unperturbed wave function but gives you the exact energies. And so, yeah, the theory of this sort of perturbation theory can be found in various references. So here, P naught is the projection. Okay, let me back up a little. So the effect of Hamiltonians, you define one for each degenerate sector of the unperturbed ground state. And once you have that, you have to solve the effect of Hamiltonian to find the splitting of that infinitely degenerate perturbed sector into the actual discrete spectrum of the many body problem we're interested in. And when you evaluate these effective Hamiltonians, this is where you do diagrams, you get renormalization, etc. And so to demonstrate what I said about how this this is what determines the equation that the zero mode needs to solve, for the ground state, P naught is the projection onto the ground state. So the effective Hamiltonian is going to take this sort of form. And then if you consider it acting on the unperturbed states, it becomes some Hamiltonian, which depends on the zero mode and its conjugate momentum, and it becomes some Schrodinger equation, which needs to be solved by these zero mode functionals. This is the step you have to do non-perturbatively. So once you have this effective Hamiltonian, once again, you just solve it non-perturbatively. And so the general structure of this, at the lowest levels, here's the how the effective Hamiltonian looks for the lowest state, the Fock vacuum. The leading order, you always get a structure like this. So what you have here is momentum plus variable squared, variable to the fourth. So what this is just the quantum mechanics. For the ON, Wilson-Fisher fixed point, it's the quantum mechanics of an n-dimensional quantum isotropic anharmonic oscillator. But what you have here, you have a 1 over L factor for the energy, but all of these coefficients are going to be universal. So they're all going to be regular expansions in epsilon. And the coefficients of epsilon here are going to depend only on what CFT you're in here is what determines that, as well as the shape of the torus, so tau, as well as the dimensionality, which is determined by epsilon. I'll mention as an aside that modular transformations, which CFT should be invariant under, leave these functions invariant. And these functions are very complicated. You get them from doing diagrams in a finite volume. Okay, so how do you solve this in an epsilon expansion, though? Because R and U are both order epsilon at the critical point. And if I just set epsilon equal to zero, I get plane waves. But once again, for any finite epsilon, this is some discrete spectrum. So one way to clarify what happens, if you just do this canonical transformation, you put it into this form here, where the epsilon dependence disappears from the quartic term and the momentum term. Now, if you take epsilon very small, you have this epsilon to the 1/3 prefactor. The quadratic term goes away. And the energy spectrum is given at lowest order by a pure quartic oscillator. And you get epsilon corrections by perturbing by the quadratic term. To put it another way, you end up mapping the problem to a series of anharmonic oscillators. And at small epsilon, it's always in the strong coupling limit. You have to start with the quartic term, first of all, and then you have to perturb by the quadratic term. As you can see from here, the energy levels are actually an expansion epsilon to the 1/3. This is something which occurred basically because you're treating part of the Gaussian Hamiltonian along with part of the interaction. And of course, it's important here that anharmonic oscillators are not particle-like. You don't have some spectrum you can solve. They're not equally spaced. Instead, you have, in general, some sort of non-equally spaced energy levels that you have to solve numerically. And the spectrum is different for different n. So depending on whether it's Ising or O2 or O3. Okay, so that was all for the brown state. If you now consider excited Fock states, you also need to derive different effective Hamiltonians. And from here, it gets very complicated. So I won't go into, or I won't describe all the details here. But for example, if you consider how the states, which are just single particle Fock states to lowest order, and you compute the effective Hamiltonian. So here, the single particle Fock states have a vector of zero mode wave functions multiplying them. You end up with some n by n coupled differential equations. And this becomes a quantum anisotropic oscillator that needs to be solved. It's still in the strong coupling limit. The tensor structure is quite complicated. And to determine the eigenstates, you have to diagonalize this equation, and then this whole wave function splits into On multiplets. So in general, you have a pretty complicated structure here, but in a way, it's giving you what you want, which is a very strongly coupled quantum mechanics problem. You have the breaking of all sorts of degeneracies into On multiplets, and well, I'll show you in a second that it gives pretty good results when you compare to exact diagonalization. So for to find all of the effective Hamiltonians, there's a diagrammatic approach, which I developed in this paper. So to give some data that from our collaborations with exact diagonalization, here I've pictured the spectrum for two values of tau, which are compared to the square torus and triangular torus. This is numerically the transverse field Ising model, which is being compared to the n equals 1 Wilson-Fischer. So here you have the states labeled by whether they're Z2 even or odd. Epsilon expansion is the unfilled circles, and ED is the filled circles. So here it says ED slash QMC. In their work, they use quantum Monte Carlo to get the speed of light. So this is something that's not determined from the lattice model, and it's not universal. I think they were able to find the lowest energy excitations for each momentum, and from that get this this prefactor. And then from there, you can just compare the energy spectrum completely. So we also looked at some O2 and O3 models and compared them in general. So here there's a few model Hamiltonians, which are known to have O2 phase transitions. So this is like an XY ferromagnet where you have anisotropy. You have some bilayer models, both with spin half per site, an XY ferromagnet on two layers. And then you have some sort of anti-ferromagnetic coupling trying to make singlets between the layers. And then you have just the O3 invariant version of that. And so once again, we have a comparison here. And here, they weren't able to find the speed of light for all three. So you need to normalize at least one energy level. And once you do that, that gets rid of the prefactor of speed of light and all of the data, and you can compare it all. And so, it's something where you can look at the spectrum, you can make sure that things match. The energy spectrum shows you what ON is, and hopefully it could be used both comparison with analytics as well as other numerics as a fingerprint of what CFT you're at. So I won't talk about the large N calculation too much here. Partially because it's a lot more standard. So the zero momentum modes don't play any sort of special role at all. You have to solve some sort of gap equation on the torus, and after that, everything else is very much just like particle-like. You have several modes that are equally spaced. At n equals infinity, you have several large degeneracies between different On multiplets. And it doesn't really agree with numerics that well, but at the same time, it does, because it's so much easier, you can, for example, tune away from criticality and get sort of some hints of the phases away. So for example, one thing that's useful when you tune into the symmetry broken phase, this is something that is already used a lot in numerics, is you can see the you can see how it tunes into the ordered phase by looking at the Anderson Tower of States. So here in the ON ordered phase, these states here are all in symmetric traceless tensor representations. The spacing between them, it goes like 1 over the area of the torus. And from here, you can sort of, you can diagnose what kind of symmetry breaking in general for a given symmetry broken state. These are the states which collapse to the ground state in the thermodynamic limit. So, as I said, I spent more time on the epsilon expansion because it's highly nonlinear. It's difficult, but in a way, it seems to give good comparison with numerics, and it seems to have a lot of this non-trivial structure. We went with a strongly coupled quantum field theory where we have to deal with it non-perturbatively, and we end up with very non-particle-like physics, as it were. But it is very dependent on this separation of the zero mode. This means that we can't really fool with it too much, as in if I tune away from criticality, I turn on a mass, and then the zero mode is fine, and it actually changes the expansion from an epsilon to 1/3 to regular epsilon. Or similarly, if I consider a torus and I try to stretch out one of the lengths, the momenta in that direction will come down, meet the zero mode, and it'll change the scaling with epsilon. So for a given epsilon expansion, you're sort of stuck with at criticality and with tori of normal length. In contrast, the large N spectrum largely resembles just a free relativistic field theory. You can just look at propagators, see where their poles are, and then you just have a bunch of equally spaced levels. But it's very easy to generalize to any finite geometry. You can tune away from criticality, etc. And then even though these expansions have very little in common, you can actually expand the large N close to small 3 minus epsilon, and you can also take the large N limit of some of these effective Hamiltonians, and it seems that they actually commute, so everything does converge to the same place. Okay, so now as a specific application, I want to talk about confinement transitions in Z2 spin liquids. So I'll sort of be a little quick here with my definition, or a little abstract, I should say, and I'll just define a Z2 spin liquid as a system with an energy gap, and you have two bosonic excitations, a spin on E and a vise on M. And they satisfy this relation where if you drag one of the particles around the other, the system picks up a phase of -1. So you can think about this as we turn to the idea of field theory, you can think about this as a Z2 lattice gauge theory, where the E and M are both deconfined particles carrying some Z2 charge. And the prototypical example is Kataev's toric code, which is a solvable Hamiltonian with this, but any sort of Z2 lattice gauge theory in a deconfined phase will realize the Z2 spin liquid. And in this picture, the E particles are... you can think of them as like electric charges which carry the Z2 charge, and the M particles as vortices of the Z2 gauge field. Of course, there are other ways to think about it too, because there's sort of a duality between switching them. Here I'm using this picture because what we want to consider is confinement transition. So I'm going to consider the idea where the particle I called E condenses. So this is, you can think about it like a Higgs transition in a gauge theory, and when you do that, the M particles will now confine. So if you have a condensate of E particles, dragging the M particle around the condensate will cost an energy which is proportional to the contour length that you drag it around in. This is just the same physics as any sort of Higgs or confinement physics. In a superconductor, trying to put flux through has an energy cost. This is sort of the same physics, but it's the Z2 gauge theory instead. So I want to talk about the phase transitions which describe e-condensation, the m particles gap. So we pretty much only need an effective theory for a bosonic field E. And as I said before, it's described in terms of some gauge invariant variable. The E's can only be created in pairs. So the first thing you would write down is just the Wilson-Fisher CFT for the Ising model. But even though this is locally just the Ising model, there's no symmetry breaking. In particular, because phi and minus phi are the same state, there's not actually two degenerate ground states in the ordered phases. In the ordered phase, both phases are gaps. They both have a unique ground state, but there's a continuous phase transition between them. Where this becomes different from the Ising model is the fact that this certain observables need to take this gauge constraint into account. So, for example, the spectrum of states on this torus, you need to project to only the gauge invariant states. And then, in addition, we can always allow twisted boundary conditions around the cycles of the torus, and this is still these are still valid configurations of the field. So we need to also include these boundary conditions. Okay, so from here you can imagine how I generalize this even more. For a scalar field, I can simply add an O(n) symmetric. I can simply make them O(n) vectors, but demand that they have Z2 gauge charges, and I'll have some sort of similar field theory. Now the Z2 is a gauge degree of freedom, so it's not a symmetry, but you have some larger physical symmetry. So I'm largely writing this down because I've already solved the Wilson-Fisher fixed point and can now apply it to this problem. But I'll mention that this has definite applications to some interesting systems. So if you put the toric code in an external field, for an example, you get an example of what I mentioned here, this Ising. It's called Ising star. And then there's some interesting models where you have O2 star. Essentially, if you have certain Bose-Hubbard models on lattices with frustration, you can realize a phase transition into a topologically ordered phase. So in the gap space here, these Z2 particles are free. So that's this deconfined gauge theory, the C2 spin liquid, and then you can have a transition into symmetry broken phases. So this is well beyond the Ginzburg-Landau paradigm. And here I'll discuss another possible phase transition, which is an O4 star, which is a phase transition out of a coplanar antiferromagnet. So this is just to demonstrate how an O(n) star transition comes out of a sort of definite system, frustrated spin system. So if you have a coplanar antiferromagnet, the order parameter can be given like this in terms of two unit vectors, which are orthogonal. So non-collinear antiferromagnets, you need to set up some sort of axes where they order along. And so here's one parameterization of it. The order parameter is usually said to live in SO3, the rotation group, the idea being to set up where the order is. You write down your axes, and there's some element of SO3 that rotates you onto where they're into whatever frame the nail order freezes into. So to find a deconfined phase by frustrating this thing, we write this in terms of some fractionalized field, which I call Z. So you can do something like this, where these order parameters are written in terms of these bosonic complex fields Z. Now, if you consider rotations of the order parameter in real space, it acts on these n's like regular rotation matrices. These z's transform as SU2 complex spinners. But this parameterization has a z2 gauge redundancy. So these things transform under SU2, but they're invariant under z2. And so you see that the symmetry here, SU2 mod z2, is SO3, and we're really describing the same symmetry breaking manifold by using these fractionalized degrees of freedom. So if you consider all of the symmetries of the original model and you try to write down the most general effective theory for Z up to irrelevant terms, you actually find that instead of just SU2 symmetry, it enlarges to a full O4 symmetry. And this is sort of an accidental thing because there are no SU2 terms you can write down which don't just flow to zero under RG. So it actually enlarges to a large O4 symmetry, but once again, these Zs are only defined up to a sign, so it's really this O4 star. This is a transition between topological order and long-range magnetic order, and the physical order parameters are some bilinear in terms of these degrees of freedom, which are really like these E particles, which now carry some spin quantum number. Okay, so for all of these examples, to calculate the spectrum, we can really piece it together by computing the Wilson-Fischer spectrum, not only on the periodic torus, but also considering these different sectors where it can have anti-periodic boundary conditions through one or both of the cycles. But then we need to take the spectra and only consider those that are even or odd under phi goes to minus phi. And from there, you take the even states, and those are the gauge invariant states that make up the ON star spectrum. So, for example, here's the large N spectrum of the O4 star. So, first of all, the critical spectrum, as I said, is universal and just determined by the fact that we have this particular phase transition, and the picking and choosing of which levels we took from these different sectors is going to make this unique from any other CFT spectra you look at. But in addition, you can look at the spectrum, you can look at the quantum numbers and see how, as you tune into the ordered phase and disordered phase, what kind of phases are nearby, as well as how they evolve in between these states. So this is the square torus, so I'll mention these black lines evolve into some ground state degeneracy. You see three states here, that's because on the square torus, this line here is two states which are degenerate, which involve the sectors antiperiodic along one or the other, but on the square torus, those are degenerate. And then as we tune into the antiferromagnet, we get this tower of states whose quantum numbers will tell you that you have some O4 symmetry breaking. For the physical spin models, you'll really have SU2 multiplets, which will collapse into these approximate O4 multiplets. And then these topologically ordered ground states actually evolve into vortices of the Z2 order parameter, which wind around the cycles of the torus. I tried to go a little fast on this last part. So the torus spectra outlook, we can extend it to other critical points, especially in an attempt to try to find fingerprints of other sort of strongly correlated lattice models. There is some work doing large N for QED3, but the large N, once again, you get this particle-like spectrum. And then this relates to trying to characterize a CFT in terms of its universal observables. How much information characterizes a CFT? Well, here's some more information, which hopefully clarifies that. Okay, and I also wanted to talk a little bit about some recent results in entanglement. So entanglement entropy, which is probably fairly familiar, is an indicator of a highly entangled ground state. So always concentrate on ground state entanglement. We have some ground state, and we trace out part of the ground state and get a reduced density matrix, and then we can compute the von Neumann entropy of that density matrix. This usually separates into some sort of area law. These are just local correlations. If you just take a product state and perturb it, you expect this term. But we're interested here in sort of universal extra terms that can probe non-local correlations in the ground state. So for a 2 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory, if you have a smooth boundary in an infinite volume, you expect to have some term that's independent of the UV cutoff, which is just a constant. And then if you have a corner, you actually can have a logarithmic divergence proportional to the size of the entangling surface and the cutoff. But the coefficient now is going to be some function of theta, which is going to also be universal. So to compare with numerics, we also want to consider semi-finite geometries. So for example, the infinite cylinder, semi-infinite cylinder, is used a lot in DMRG. Here, the cylinder entropy takes this form. Here I'm taking an infinite cylinder and just cutting it in half. And I've added a parameter which I've called phi y, which is just a twist in the cylindrical direction. So you can put a theory on a cylinder. You can consider periodic boundary conditions around the cylinder. The entropy will depend on the periodic boundary conditions, and it'll depend on what CFT you're at. And then for the torus as well, there's been numerical studies on these. You once again have an area law and then a constant term, which depends on the ratios of all the lengths in the problem, as well as any sort of boundary conditions you introduce. So very little is known, or very little analytics for interacting CFTs exist. But free field theory is understood, I would say, fairly well. At least we know how we can, for a given geometry, numerically calculate it pretty easily. For interacting theories, on the circular disk, there's a relation between the entanglement entropy and the free energy on the sphere. This is the F theorem. So there are some results there. There's results in holographic theories. And there is a paper studying the Wilson-Fisher epsilon expansion on this infinite cylindrical geometry. There, the issues with zero modes that I mentioned on my torus work are very difficult to deal with for the same reason. So they introduce this twist, basically, to gap out the theory. And so in a way, they're missing out on these sort of zero mode degrees of freedom. Our new result is that if you take the large end limit of Wilson-Fisher, Gross-Naveau, there's some mapping between the entanglement entropy in pretty much any geometry and the free field entanglement entropy in a similar geometry. So to sort of quickly, so in quantum field theory, usually compute entanglement via the replica method. So there's a formula here which gives you the reduced density matrix to some power trace over in terms of computing the partition function of your QFT on some replicated space. The replicated space, if you want to compute trace rho A to the N, is N copies of the theory. You take the region you want to compute the entanglement of, and you create these conical singularities which attach the different replicas to each other. So it's some very complicated surface with conical singularities. But once you have that, you can compute the entanglement entropy by considering the number of replicas close to one. That's what we're going to use here. So the reason why the calculation works has partly to do with the structure of the Wilson-Fisher CFT at large N. So I'll just mention sort of the relevant properties. So this describes the same CFT as the theory I gave before. I've introduced an auxiliary field. If you integrate this out, it imposes a unit constraint on the phi field. But if we instead integrate the phi out, we get factors of N in front of the whole Lagrangian. And then we can determine the free energy because the configuration of the remaining field lambda will just be given by a saddle point as you take N large because everything's proportional to N. So you solve the saddle point equations. Now, if you have translation invariance, you know that the saddle point lambda is just going to be a constant. And because this is a CFT and an infinite volume, I'll mention the constant that the saddle point equals turns out to be the mass gap of the theory. So because this is a CFT on an infinite volume, the mass gap will just be zero. But when we solve these equations on some finite volume, the Wilson-Fisher CFT will have some sort of universal gap given by the geometry you're in. Once you calculate these saddle point equations, the free energy is basically given by the free energy of N free scalars, where their mass is given by this universal saddle point value. So now if you want to compute the entanglement entropy, this becomes very complicated because you don't have translation invariance. So the first, so in general, if you want to compute trace rho to the N, you have to solve some QFT problem without translation invariance. You have these conical singularities, so you have certain divergences of this field, and it's extremely complicated. But if we're just interested in the entanglement entropy, we only need the dependence close to one replica. So we can imagine expanding the form of this constraint field to leading order. It's just what it is on one replica, which is the mass gap. and then the functional dependence will appear in just the deviation away from n equals 1. And now we compute the entanglement entropy by finding the free energy, once again, close to one replica, and it'll depend on this eta, which is n plus 1. First of all, it'll depend because the Laplacian on the replicated space will depend on the number of replicas, and then it'll depend on this constraint field, just like this. And so leading order in eta, we can write it like this. So this allows a drastic simplification. So I'll just give a few lines of equations here. This is what I wrote before for what the entanglement entropy is. And now if you just expand in what eta is, first of all, you get a term here which is evaluated simply at the free field value of the mass gap n squared. And then we get a dependence on this complicated f of x. But when we expand this thing out, the key idea here is that the gap equation sets this coefficient to zero. So even though we don't know f of x, its contribution to the entanglement entropy always vanishes at large n. And then we use the fact that this free energy is the free energy of free scalars on the replicated space, and that if we were to go through this whole calculation and compute the entropy for free scalars, we would get this thing. But now the mass is determined by the CFT, by solving the large n gap equations. So we've mapped it to some free field entanglement with some mass gap, which is determined by the CFT. So this is what I said. I didn't talk about the Gross-Naveau CFT, but this whole argument is identical for that. In contrast, for the Rényi entropies, which involve trace rho to the n, you need to solve some complicated gap equation. So from here, you can first of all, I'll mention that there are a few cases where large n entanglement was already known and free field entanglement was known. And I'll just mention the circular disk. I said there were already results. Everything agrees there. If you take sharp corners where the corner is nearly smooth, both free field and large n entanglement, the coefficient was known. And once again, it agrees with the formula we have. But now we can also consider new geometries where we can use this mapping to free fields to get results. So for example, here's a torus with square boundary conditions, and here we take a twist along one direction. We compare the blue as a Gaussian field with no mass, and then the red is a Wilson-Fisher. So you determine the mass by essentially doing my torus calculation, finding the mass gap on the torus, and you can compare how the entanglement entropy changes as you flow from Gaussian to Wilson-Fisher. The black line here is as you take the cut on the torus LA here very small, then you know it maps to some entanglement in infinite space, which is known, and they become the same. And so these are sort of new results you can try to compare to numerics. So interestingly, if you take this cylindrical geometry, you can exactly compute what gamma is analytically using the replica method. You solve the gap equation, you can consider some sort of twist, and you plug the resulting mass gap into the equation for free field entanglement, you always find that gamma on the cylinder vanishes. So if you expand the entanglement entropy in powers of n, the term proportional to n will always vanish on the cylinder for the Wilson-Fisher and Gross-Naveau CFTs, which is pretty strange because for the Gaussian fixed point, the entanglement entropy will be of order n. So you get this huge decrease in gamma as you flow from the Gaussian fixed point to the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Okay, so I'll mention here, this is some data from a recent paper that came out on Thursday. There's this lattice model where you can compute. There's a lattice model which is known to tune from a free Dirac theory into a Gross-Naveau theory. And here here n is equal to 2, so it probably won't show this reduction in such a drastic way. What they do is they consider cylinders with these twist boundary conditions, and then they actually vary the twists, and they compare the gamma they calculate to the free Dirac gamma with some coefficient. And what they find is that as they tune into the Dirac phase, they find the Dirac entanglement entropy as expected. And as they tune to VC, where you have the gross Nouveau CFT, you have some drop-off of the entanglement entropy there. And so there seems to be some sort of decrease on the cylinder. The hope would be as you increased in, this would be even more dramatic. Okay, and so to mention a bit of outlook, we were really interested in finding the Rinne entropies at large N, on the infinite cylinder anyways, where the gap equation at least only depends on the distance to the cut in the cylinder. There's some interesting structure there. We weren't able to solve the problem, but it's something that I think could be done in the future. I think computing for these large N theories what the order one correction is to the entropy is interesting, just to know what the first order shift is you expect here. And then also mention, from the torus, we know that these zero modes on these finite volumes are extremely important in giving this sort of strongly coupled physics. So you might wonder if you can do the epsilon expansion on the cylinder, but actually have periodic boundary conditions, which they couldn't handle in this paper because they couldn't, because they didn't want to treat the zero modes. Okay. And so I'll just end by thanking my collaborators. Andreas Lauschley's group at Innsbruck did the exact diagonalization. The entropy work was done in collaboration with William Woodsack Krempa, and then all of this was done with my advisor, Subir. Thank you.
Thank you. So I don't know whether it works, but we can try to do a couple of questions. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any question from the audience?
So, when you separate this zero mode from the harmonic oscillator, I'm talking about the first part of your talk. So there are a couple.
Sorry, it's cutting out really bad.
Wait, this is the microphone, right? So let's try.
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay, so when you separate the zero mode from the non-zero mode in the first part of your talk.
Mm-hmm.
So the full Hamiltonian has coupling between them.
Yes.
And then, but then you said for the zero mode Hamiltonian, the expansion is in epsilon to the 1/3. Is that? And then
yes.
For the. So how do you treat the coupling between zero mode and the non-zero mode? So do you first assume non-zero modes are say in the ground state? But do you have to know, don't you have to know the state of the zero mode before you decide the ground state for the non-zero mode? How does that work?
So if I understand your question correctly, the coupling between the non-zero modes and zero modes is computed when I do this effective Hamiltonian. And so by doing these projection operators, I'm effectively integrating out these sort of non-zero modes to figure out what the Hamiltonian is for the zero modes. And so from there, you are treating these non-linearities in the non-zero modes with the zero modes. And sorry, what was the rest of your question? I want to make sure I answer it.
Yeah, so I was just wondering how the full expansion is organized. Because one is, so is there epsilon to the 1/3 feedback from zero mode to the non-zero mode, or?
Yeah, there is. So maybe I should have shown some of the diagrams. I mentioned here that I have this whole diagrammatic approach in this paper. So you can sort of use this sort of canonical transformation as a guide. The zero modes basically come with an extra power of epsilon minus a sixth attached to them. So now when you expand out the quartic term, you have a term that's quartic in the zero modes, but then you have, say, a term that couples two zero modes to two finite momentum modes. And this will have some power of epsilon determined by the fact that the quartic term has the power of epsilon because it's proportional to U, but then it has two powers of the zero modes, which lowers its power of epsilon by minus a third. So that'll be minus 2/3, for example. etc. And so, yeah, I'll mention it becomes quite complicated. You can write down sort of this diagrammatic expansion where the number of zero modes will alter the epsilon power by a certain amount.
So is it correct then, if you compute, say, some critical exponent, then it will have some fractional powers of epsilon, but they are down by 1 over L. Is that?
Well, critical exponents are defined in the infinite system. So
yeah,
that's why they all end up just being regular expansions in epsilon.
If we define it from some intermediate size scale.
The critical exponents will satisfy finite size scaling, but you can instead consider some sort of observable which depends on the size of the system.
That's right.
That will be some fractional expansion epsilon, yes. And so, it will be an expansion epsilon 1/3.
So do you
these
know
observables which depend?
Say,
on
do you know how two-point function say behaves?
The two-point function on the torus. No, not in general, no. I'd have to give that some thought, but once again, you have to treat these zero modes exactly. Maybe I can map that to some quantum problem too. It's an interesting question.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks. Are there any other questions? No, if there are no other questions, well, thanks. I think it worked well. So thanks again for your talk.
All right.